Hello, this is your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan, bringing you the March 3rd edition of the New Yorker magazine. Today's main story is Dredging Up the Ghostly Secrets of the Slave Ships by Julian Lucas. Annals of the Sea, Dredging Up the Ghostly Secrets of Slave Ships. A global network of maritime archaeologists is excavating slave shipwrecks and reconnecting Black communities to the deep, by Julian Lucas. On the way down, I saw nothing. The water was a blur of teal fringed with rusty shadows, darkening about 20 feet below to a sickly emerald. I followed a rope strung between a buoy and a stake in the seabed, pausing occasionally to pinch my nose and adjust my sinuses to the pressure. Just beyond the thermocline, where the temperature abruptly drops, a hand emerged from the murk and grabbed me by the wrist, dragging me the last few inches to the bottom. The silt was as soft as tapioca pudding. It swallowed my hand, then my arm and shoulder. The deeper I pushed, the more I suspected that it might go on forever. Finally, I touched wood, feeling a chill colder than the waters as I ran my fingertips over the grooves and splinters of submerged planks. This was the slave ship Camargo, which carried 500 souls across the Atlantic before it burned. It was the 6th of November, and I was diving with a group of maritime archaeologists in Angra dos Reis, a verdant bay just 3 hours from Rio de Janeiro. It's a kind of Brazilian Hamptons, where yachts fill the marinas and Vogue once sponsored a party for New Year's Eve. But in the 19th century, it was mostly plantations, sugar cane near the water and coffee just beyond the jagged mountains that ring the area like snaggle teeth. They thrust up around me as I resurface, pressing a button to inflate my scuba kit's buoyancy control device. The researcher who guided me to the wreck showed me the soot under our fingernails. Then we swam back to the dive boat, a creaky flat-bottom rental whose Portuguese name meant, "With Jesus, I will win." On board, preparations were underway to disinter the Camargo, a two-masted brig that sank in 1852. A storm had buried the ship shortly after its discovery the previous December. Now it was time to clear away the mud. Divers had spent the morning setting out buoys, running submarine guidelines, and surveying the site, working creatively with modest tools. Two men assembled a dredge from a PVC pipe and a household grease trap. Another hailed a nearby mega yacht to borrow its sub-bottom profiler, a costly sonar device that exposes buried features. "We're using the rich," he said, "it's reparations." 10 years ago, not one ship that sank in the Middle Passage had ever been identified. The African diaspora's watery cradle was an archaeological blank, as though the sea had erased all trace of what the poet Robert Hayden called voyage through death to life upon these shores. Then, in 2015, a Portuguese ship called the São José was discovered off the coast of Cape Town. 3 years later, the Clotilda, America's last known slave ship, turned up in Alabama's Mobile River. The most recent find is believed to be L'Horreur, a French vessel that sank off the coast of Mozambique after an attempted uprising. Meanwhile, in Dakar, researchers are closing in on the Senegal, which exploded after its capture by the British Navy in 1781. Behind his fleets of run events is a network called the Slave Wrecks Project, coordinated by the Smithsonian, along with George Washington University, the Iziko Museums of South Africa, and the U.S. National Park Service. The SWP combines maritime archaeology with reparative justice, tourism, and aquatic training in Black communities. Its work is too new to gauge its impact on scholarship, but it has already made a meaningful contribution to public history. Artifacts from the São José have become a centerpiece of the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture, NMAAHC. The Clotilda inspired a Netflix documentary and a new museum in Africatown, Alabama, and similar hopes are riding on the Camargo in Angra dos Reis. The enthusiasm reflects an oceanic turn in understandings of heritage among diasporic writers, artists, and scholars who are increasingly preoccupied with what the influential theorist Christiana Sharp calls slavery's wake. Before my descent, I spoke with Gabrielle Miller, a maritime archaeologist at the Smithsonian, whom I found strapping a stainless steel knife to her muscular calf. A 32-year-old with cowrie shells in her long box braids and a pierced septum, she teared up describing her underwater work. There was a hush over it, almost like a church, she said, of her first dive to Slave's Wreck, feeling that Camargo was even more uncannily intimate. The black stayed on my hands for a long time. Miller works for the NMAAHC and contributed to an ongoing exhibition, In Slavery's Wake, which featured beads and shells that enslaved Africans likely carried to Brazil. But she'd rather talk about being in the water than about what divers can retrieve from it. It's very antiquarian to pull all of the emphasis on the physical object, she said. The ship is a catalyst. Miller started off in terrestrial archaeology and once worked for the Nez Perce tribe in Idaho. But a research trip to St. Croix, where her family originated, led her to become a scuba diver and to apply her skills to the histories of her own people. In 2021, Miller enrolled in an SWP-affiliated internship program, which she now helps to run. She also teaches the basics of maritime archaeology through the Slave Wrecks Project Academy, which works with archaeology graduate students in Senegal and Mozambique. The Academy's two-pronged goal is to diversify the ranks of archaeologists, a minuscule fraction of whom are Black, and to include people from across the diaspora in the study of its history. Yet it's also kind of exorcism, an exercise in dispelling history's haints. They say that the African diasporic relationship to water equals trauma, Miller told me, alluding to an all-too-familiar tale of Middle Passage drownings, contaminated taps, and segregated beaches. It wasn't exactly false, she conceded, but didn't Black people also have a privileged connection to the sea? She spoke rapturously of coral architecture in the Caribbean, of water spirits venerated by Senegal's seafaring Lebu, and of work by the artist Ayana V. Jackson, who was inspired to learn diving by the Afrofuturist myth of Drexia. Created in the 90s by a Detroit electronica duo, it imagines a Black Atlantis populated by the water-breathing issues of women who drowned in the crossing. The idea fortified me when I sat on the dive boat's rail and prepared to fall overboard. Within the siren call of the sunken place is an invitation to courage, Miller suggested. Our ancestral relationship to water is not one of fear. The Slaver is a ghost ship sailing on the edges of modern consciousness, Marcus Rediker writes in his harrowing history, The Slave Ship. The vessels were floating torture chambers that devoured more than 12 million lives and their finely calibrated cruelties. Lightless holds fetid with vomit and excrement. Sick people bound to anchor chains and thrown en masse to waiting sharks, fueled by the global economy for half a millennium. They left a psychic imprint so deep that Black people still speak of them in terms of personal experience. I remember on the slave ship how they brutalized our very souls, Bob Marley sings in Slave Driver. One might have assumed that a handful of these vessels, at least 800 of which are known to have wrecked, would have turned up long ago. But those equipped to search for them have lacked incentive to do so. In 1972, commercial treasure hunters stumbled on the wreck of the Henrietta Marie, an English ship that sank near the Florida Keys after a slaving voyage, and moved on as soon as they realized that it wasn't the Spanish galleon they were seeking. It was later excavated. Maritime archaeologists, meanwhile, largely ignored the Middle Passage. Stephen Lubkeman, a professor at George Washington University, told me, "There were more archaeological studies of cogs and bogs in Ireland than of slave ships." Lubkeman conceived of the SWP in 2003. Slavery wasn't his field, but he long marveled that historians, who'd recently unveiled the monumental Transatlantic Slave Trade Database, were so far ahead of his social science peers. Because of its expense, maritime archaeology is reliant on funding from governments, few of which wanted to pay for the exposure of their historical crimes. An exception was post-apartheid South Africa, where Jaco Bashoff, a researcher at the Iziko Museums, was looking for a Dutch slaver called the Merriman. He and Lubkeman joined forces and expanded the search to other ships, shuttling between nautical archives and Cape Town's wreck-strewn littoral. For years, both dollars and discoveries eluded them. Then in 2008, Bashoff encountered a scholarly citation about a Portuguese ship that sank en route from Mozambique to Brazil, carrying 200 Africans to their deaths. Further research led to the captain's testimony, which indicated a spot under a mountain known as Lion's Head. Soon, Bashoff and his team were diving at what he called one of the worst wreck sites I've ever worked on. The archaeologists were dashed against the very reefs that had sunk the vessel. One almost drowned. Still worse, the wreck was itself a wreck, having already been stripped by treasure hunters in the 1980s. They found human remains, which have since disappeared. Just enough remained to identify the vessel. Crumpled copper sheathing from the period, iron ballast blocks that were mentioned in the manifest, and most crucially, timber from a tropical hardwood that grew in Mozambique. By 2015, Bashoff and Lubkeman were confident enough to announce that they'd found the São José, the first known wreck of a ship that sank during a slaving voyage. Their discovery was perfectly timed. In the early 2010s, Lonnie Bunch, the founding director of the soon-to-open NMAAHC, was determined to acquire a relic of the Middle Passage. The slave trade was where the modern world began. Bunch, who is now the secretary of the Smithsonian, told me, "I needed to be able to tell that story in an intimate way." After realizing how few existed, he negotiated a partnership with the SWP and supported its search for the São José. The museum opened in September 2016, with artifacts from the ship showcased in a subterranean gallery evocative of a slaver's hold. Bunch attended a ceremony to honor the São José's victims in Mozambique, where traditional rulers presented him with a container of earth to scatter over the wreck. When a young Mozambican tearfully thanked him for bringing her kidnapped countrymen home, Bunch had a revelation. What we were looking for wasn't about yesterday, but today. Every morning before diving, and every evening afterward, the team excavating the Camargo dined on a local historian's back porch. Her mint greenhouse in Fraid, a gated condominium on the bay, served as a base for the expedition, whose members would relax around a table near a pool and a tree with fuchsia blossoms. Leaving their wetsuits out to dry on the patio furniture, they'd feast on feijoada and other Brazilian specialties, speaking in a mix of Portuguese, English, French, and Spanish that they'd christened Portugolesano. Having no common language was no obstacle to camaraderie. Miller entertained the table with the story of Notalida, a wreck mistakenly identified as the Clotilde. I was teased for having studied with the wrong dive federation. The expedition's genial young field coordinator, Luis Felipe Santos, drew the most laughs because he couldn't pronounce boy. Santos is a stout 35-year-old tattooed with nautical motifs, orisha symbols, and a demon's head caption, "Tropical Punk." He's a professor of maritime archaeology at the Federal University of Bahia and serves as the president of Afro Origins, a nonprofit established to find the wrecks of slave ships. Having found the Caramago, they've begun surveying near the town of Marica for the wrecks of the Maltesia, which was sunk by the British Navy. A self-identified Afro-Indigenous Brazilian, he co-founded the country's first organization of Black archaeologists. But his work hardly touched on slavery until he was invited to join a year-long search for the Caramago, which then began appearing in his dreams. Several other archaeologists experienced similar visions, and he speculated, half playfully, that African cosmology was responsible. The energy of the wreck called all of us. Nothing so dramatic had befallen me, yet the prospect of coming so close to an unknowable history, which my own ancestors had survived, did inspire me to learn scuba. Just a month earlier, I'd enrolled at a hole-in-the-wall school in New York, where the instructor taught me and two white bankers to maximize our bottom time. Surrounded by decorative shark plushies, I couldn't have felt farther from the grim story of the Caramago. I didn't yet know that Manhattan was where its captain financed his slaving expeditions and eventually met an unexpected end. Of the thousands of vessels involved in the Atlantic slave trade, the Caramago has two distinctions. It's the last slaver known to have reached Brazil, which outlawed the slave trade, though not slavery, in 1850. And its captain, Nathaniel Gordon, an American from Portland, Maine, was the only man ever executed for slave trafficking in the United States. Gordon had absconded with the Caramago while transporting ordinary merchandise from San Francisco to New York. He then set a more profitable course for Mozambique, where he purchased his human cargo. Pursued by the British Navy, he torched the ship after unloading its 500 captives, who were sold to local plantations. Brazilian authorities arrested several crew members, but Gordon managed to escape, disguised in women's clothes. He made two more slaving voyages before the U.S. Navy finally caught him in 1860. Even then, he likely expected to go free. Although the international slave trade had been illegal for decades, the ban was hardly ever enforced, especially not in New York, which Horace Greeley described as a nest of slave pirates. Wall Street investors regularly financed slaving expeditions, and bribery of customs officers and juries was rife. But Gordon was tried by Lincoln's Justice Department, whose attorneys were eager to make an example of a brazen trafficker as the Civil War got underway. Gordon was convicted and sentenced to death. The ruling sparked a nationwide argument. Was it fair to execute a man for violating a dead-letter law, particularly when the domestic slave trade was perfectly legal in much of the country? Ralph Waldo Emerson lobbied for the captain's execution. Gordon's wife presented Mary Todd Lincoln with a rhyming plea for clemency. The president decided to let the captain hang, telling one petitioner that any man who, for a paltry gain and stimulated only by avarice, can rob Africa of her children to sell them into interminable bondage, I never will pardon. After an unsuccessful suicide attempt, Gordon was duly executed at the Tombs on February 21, 1862. He insisted from the gallows that he was an innocent family man who'd never intentionally harmed another human being in his life. Yuri Sanada, a filmmaker with an unruly salt and pepper bowl cut, found the story irresistible. "Nobody knows more about shipwrecks than I do," he told me. "I had my own." Although he lacks a degree in archaeology, Sanada is a consummate adventurer who'd done everything from sailing a replica Phoenician galley across the Atlantic to salvaging his own furniture from the wreck of the houseboat where he and his wife lived for 12 years. He read about Gordon's misadventures in a 2006 book by Ron Sudalter and immediately proposed a film adaptation. He also pitched the author a daring idea. James Cameron had descended to the already discovered Titanic to research his Titanic. Sanada would out Cameron by locating the wreck of the Camargo. He teamed up with Gilson Rambelli, a maritime archaeologist at the Federal University of Sergipe, who had led an unsuccessful search for the Camargo in the early 2000s and was trying to renew the effort. He had come within a few yards. Rambelli led the campaign, which the SWP agreed to fund and support beginning in 2022. We spent hundreds of hours poking the bottom with this big 9-foot iron rod, Senator recalled, as target after target revealed by magnetomer survey let them down. One day, a passing fisherman boasted that he knew the wreck's location. It was the last dive of the last day of the last exhibition, Senada explained, and they were desperate enough to invite him aboard. He took them to an island that his father had known as a popular spawning ground, yet even he looked surprised when a diver resurfaced with fragments of charred wood. We came to legitimate something that was already legitimate, Santos said, of the discovery, which corroborated local lore about the wreck. He believes that archaeology can be a tool for justice, particularly in Brazil, where the omissions of colonial archives have underwritten the displacement of Black and Indigenous peoples. Santos's research hadn't previously focused on the African diaspora, but he began to feel an ancestral call. For me, it's not about the study of the other, he told me. I see myself in the artifact. Miller sat cross-legged on a paddleboard and rowed toward the mountains with slow, deliberate strokes. She dipped her face into the water at intervals. Once or twice, she slid herself off the board, inhaled sharply, and dived to the bottom. But there was no sign of the Camargo and the miasma, she shouted back to Santos, who tossed her a plastic-wrapped GPS. Soon the wreck found Miller and another archaeologist were descending to it with a dredge, which was attached via fire hose to a motor on deck. They signaled with a stream of bubbles once they were ready to begin. Senator yanked a pull cord, and the contraption roared to life. But the hose clogged with debris and popped off, soaking everyone on deck. Senator grinned ruefully. 1 point for the pump, 0 for the archaeologists. In the popular imagination, excavating a shipwreck is like exploring a rune, an odyssey, though, through a drowned world. The reality is that many shipwrecks are found in pieces, looted by salvagers, gnawed at by shipworms, and damaged by passing vessels. They become hard to distinguish from anonymous debris. The difficulty is heightened by zero visibility conditions. Ensconced in a turbid bay, the Camargo has become a puzzle for Braille archaeology, the art of forensic reconstruction via touch. We have to feel for each meter, Miller, back on deck, explained. The archaeologists were using their hands, arms, and wingspans to map the site. They'd begun by outlining the wreck with 12 numbered stakes, each attached to a buoy on the surface. Then they had run a line between them, using two other lines to trace the axes of a rough grid. Now they were digging square meter test pits in search of distinctive features, which they sketched by feel on waterproof slates. Eventually, a site plan would emerge from this collaborative hallucination, hopefully revealing the wreck's orientation on the bottom. The plan was already beginning to emerge on a sheet of mylar graph paper, an oval surrounded by arrows with a handful of anomalous objects marked. Santos had found a huge hunk of metal near one end of the site. Miller, when she examined it, had felt a smaller one with the tip of her fin, which turned out to be hollow and cylindrical. She lay face down on deck to show the distance between the two to Senada, who had planned to photograph the objects by pressing a clear plastic bag of water against them. He invited me to watch. Before long, we were feeling our way along the seafloor, pausing briefly where the two rope axes converged. I couldn't help but think of the crossroads, a geometric figure common throughout the African diaspora that symbolizes the boundary between the living and the dead. According to certain cosmologies, their souls take on the guise of marine creatures, an idea that struck me as strangely comforting. During my certification dive at a flooded quarry in eastern Pennsylvania, I'd felt surreally out of place, balking at the vast darkness around me as I stared into the eyes of a bass who'd taken up residence in the cockpit of a submerged Cessna. Here, though, I could imagine myself surrounded by kindred spirits. We swam onto the object that Santos had found earlier. It was barrel-shaped and about the diameter of my wingspan, with a pocked and pitted texture that prompted intrusive thoughts of tetanus. For a few seconds, the water cleared enough to see something that resembled a cross between a hairball and a meteor. It's what's called in maritime archaeology a concretion, which forms when an iron object corrodes in salt water. Ferrous ions precipitate around its dissolving form, which is preserved as though through in a mold. The result is exceedingly fragile, and it disintegrates if allowed to dry. But when X-rayed, concretions yield manifold secrets. The renowned Canadian maritime archaeologist Marc-André Bernier told me that he's watched cannons, kettles, muskets, and even a finely wrought scale emerge from lumps of nothing. Later that day, Bernier led a discussion of the concretion in the historian's living room. He clicked through reference images of 19th century brigs as the other archaeologists nursed spears and hazarded hypotheses. Could it be the anchor? Santos thought it might be the hatch. Bernier asked Miller about the tubular object she found nearby. He suspected that it was the hawsepipe, an outlet for the anchor chain. In that case, the bigger object was likely the windlass, a winch-like machine used to hoist the anchor. Bernier tested this hypothesis the next day. He dived to the wreck several times and sketched the bigger object, which seemed to have two barrels and a shaft in between, before resurfacing with the triumphant announcement. The widths are the same size, the holes are the same size, the shafts are the same size, he said, outlining each shape with his hands. It's the windlass. Miller closed her eyes and extended her arms like a mystic. He sees the ship in his mind. Given how much is known about slave ships, it's fair to ask if excavating them will fundamentally alter conceptions of the Middle Passage. Redeker, the historian, praised maritime archaeologists for retrieving palatable traces of what the enslaved suffered, but doubts that they will learn much from the vessels themselves. It's one thing to have plans, Bernier said of such skepticism, but a ship is a living thing. Most slavers were ordinary vessels that crews modified en route, adding features like the barricado, an anti-mutiny fortification, and the cramped compartments below decks where captives were stowed. In Alabama and Mozambique, researchers are excavating such holds for the first time and hope to retrieve objects that captives smuggled across the Atlantic. Their ultimate goal is to link these discoveries to slavery's contemporary legacy. Studying the São José has taken researchers to the ruins of its owner's palace in Lisbon. The excavations of Loureiro is proceeding in tandem with fieldwork in rural Mozambique. In one village, an oral tradition pointed to a rune on a nearby island, which had once been a barracoon. Members of a black scuba nonprofit called Diving with a Purpose, which joined the SWP in 2014, recently led a delegation to Liberia, where they met with descendants of escapees from the Guerrero, a slave ship that sank in the Florida Keys. Diving with a Purpose was established in the mid-aughts to find the Guerrero, which remains at large, but the group's annual searches have become a floating school for black scuba divers, including teens from Florida high schools. African Americans have a particular connectedness to the ocean, Jay Hagler, a lead instructor with the program, told me. You're listening to the New Yorker magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona, read by your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. How the hell did we get over here? On a goddamn boat. And it wasn't the Nina, the Pinta, or the Santa Maria. An affable, mustachioed, former real estate developer, Hagler joined the group after meeting some black scuba divers at a wedding. Now he has worked on wrecks all over the world, including the Clotilda and the downplanes of Tuskegee Airmen in the Mediterranean. To him, it's not an accident that recent breakthroughs in the archaeology of the Middle Passage have involved the participation of black divers. If we're not part of the ocean, our stories are never told. Overlooking the bay from the foothills of the Serra do Mar is the Quilombo Santorita do Bracoa. Situated between a muddy river and a tropical forest, it's a historically black community that is home to 373 families, many of whom live in unfinished houses with corrugated roofs. The Quilombo, a term for a rural settlement established by the formerly enslaved, is less than 10 minutes from the water, yet it's practically unknown to the area's more affluent residents. Like a lot of people from Rio de Janeiro, I have never heard of them, the historian Martha Ebro, who vacationed nearby in her youth, recalled. I was a white person with a white family who came to have pleasure in Angra dos Reis. Abro, a tiny, ebullient scholar with a high-pitched voice, was the archaeologist's host. Her father had purchased the property where they were staying in the 1980s, when a new highway was transforming the bay into a tourism hub. With the assistance of Brazil's military government, speculators seized valuable waterfront land from black residents who retreated to the hills. Their Quilombo dates back to the 1870s, when the owners of a sugar plantation bequeathed it to those he'd enslaved. He was one of the planters who'd illegally bought Africans from the Camargo, and they disembarked on his property, arriving in canoes in the dead of night as the ship was set aflame. The aftermath brought Brazil's clandestine slave trade to a permanent end. As police scoured local plantations for the trafficked Africans, a number of their legitimately enslaved brethren ran away. Some posed as new arrivals to avoid re-enslavement. The chaos stoked fears of another Haiti before it was quashed and forgotten. When Abro first visited the Quilombo Bracui in the early 2000s, she'd already published an article about the incident and was shocked to discover that its memory had endured in the Quilombo's oral tradition. Certain aspects of the narrative had assumed legendary dimensions. Quilombo's told Abro that Gordon, fearing discovery, had let most of those aboard the Camargo drown, while archival sources suggested that they'd landed safely. Other particulars were almost uncannily precise, she said. They knew everything about slavery, the owner's will, and the traffic. This was a hidden story, Marilda de Souza Francisco, a former leader of the Quilombo, said when I visited. Now we want everyone to know. As an assistant farmer in her 60s, she and other community members set up a memorial to the Briggs victims near her house, an airy, low-slung building covered in old pink plaster, where dogs barked under the banana and palm trees. A sign on her wraparound of her veranda cites Brazil's post-dictatorship constitution, which grants the remaining members of the ancient runaway slave communities ownership of their traditional lands. The provision was ratified in the late 1980s, but conservatives allied with the country's agricultural lobby have long impeded its enforcement. Only a handful of the nearly 3,000 communities that have applied for official status have been granted land titles. Francisco hopes that the attention brought by the the Camargo's discovery will make hers one of them. We are in a hurry, but the law is very slow. The Quilombos suffer from unemployment, the illegal destruction of the mangrove swamps where they've traditionally fished, and the theft of land and water for wealthier neighborhoods on the waterfront. Their access to the river was recently blocked. Last May, Lonnie Bunch visited, bringing a burst of attention from government officials who had previously neglected these problems. But the immediate hope is that the Camargo will create jobs and attract tourists. Afro Origins recently constructed a small base in the Quilombo, where it plans to exhibit artifacts from the excavation. The organization is training young Quilombos to scuba dive, with the aim of allowing them to become stewards of the wreck site. Although the excavation has just begun, there's also talk of commemoration. Francisco's dream is a floating memorial to the Camargo. She recently watched a documentary about the discovery of another slave ship, which had revived a small town on Alabama's Gulf Coast. Perhaps it would happen again. 8 years after the Camargo's destruction, America's last slave ship met an identical fate. Returning from Ouda in present-day Benin, the schooner Clotilde stole into Alabama's Mobile River with 110 Africans, a victory for its owner, Timothy Mayer, who'd wagered that he could defy the country's slave trade ban. The captain burned the ship and sank it in a bayou. The captives, nearly all Yoruba speakers from the same village, toiled on plantations for the next 5 years. After the Civil War, a few dozen survivors banded together to buy land from Mar and established a community called Africa Town. The settlement's recent memory of enslavement was unique in the United States. In the late 1920s, Zora Neale Hurston interviewed one of its founders, Cujo Lewis Ni Uala Kosala, who vividly remembered the terror of the crossing. The sea growled like a thousand beasts in the bush. But the town's cohesion frayed in the late 20th century as factories shuttered, leaving behind dangerous pollution and the construction of an interstate highway demolished the historic downtown. Africatown's population plummeted, and its singular history threatened to fade. Then in 2018, a local journalist, Ben Rains, located the wreck of the Clotilde, whose identity was confirmed the next year by archaeologists. It was the most intact wreck of a slave ship ever found. Africatown was deluged with attention. A filmmaker interviewed tearful residents for a documentary, which was subsequently acquired by the Obamas and Netflix. National Geographic made two others. For the second, Clotilde descendants traveled to Benin, where they confronted the king, whose predecessor had enslaved their ancestors, scattered soil taken from their graves in Alabama, and visited the Door of No Return, a monument that frames the Atlantic. Back in Africatown, a modest museum, the Heritage House, opened in 2023 with fragments of the Clotilde exhibited in pH-controlled tanks. Some descendants have begun running boat tours in the Mobile River. Others are receiving free swimming and scuba lessons through the SWP in the hope of eventually visiting the wreck site. "I just want to touch it," Evelyn Milton, an IT professional who plans to earn her scuba certification this spring, told me. "If I could take a rose or some type of pennant, something the ologists think is safe, to leave on the ship as a way to say, hey, I'm your fourth great-granddaughter. You're never going to believe this, but I work from home. Thank you." Anderson Cooper recently moderated on an on-air reckoning between the Clotilde Descendants Association and two members of the Mara family, which still owns a substantial amount of property in and around Africatown and has rented it to the very factories that locals blame for occurrences of cancer. After the Clotilda was discovered, the family sold a plot of land to the community for a fraction of its market value. It has since become a food bank. During the interview, they also presented one of the descendants, Pat Fraser, with a silver-tipped cane that had belonged to the enslaver of her great-grandparents. It was a set-piece moment of racial reconciliation. Still, Fraser regarded the heirloom skeptically, as though she had expected more. "I thought I was going to see Montgomery again," Fraser told me, alluding to the National Memorial for Peace and Justice, which has revitalized the state's capital. The dream of communal archaeology is that communities might benefit from the excavation of their history. A few years ago, Bolivian indigenous groups sued for salvage rights to a Spanish treasure galleon, arguing that its unprecedented haul of gold, silver, and emeralds had emerged from mines where their ancestors were enslaved. But it isn't easy to parlay excavations into reparations. Fraser believes that the efforts have been hindered by friction between local and out-of-state descendants and between those groups and non-descendant residents who feel excluded from the media bonanza. Others feel that the ship is a distraction from the community that its survivors established. And then there's the question of what to do with the wreck. Initially, Africatown was a buzz with talk of raising and exhibiting the Clotilda, like the Vasa worship in Stockholm. Perhaps it could be a tourist attraction, a memorial, and an implicit rebuke to conservative lawmakers who wanted to erase slavery from the state's textbooks. But this hope was dashed by a recent report from the Alabama Historical Commission, which concluded that the wreck was more fragile than previously believed and that raising it would cost upward of $30 million. The recommended alternative was to rebury the Clotilda in the mud, preserving its archaeological integrity for future generations. Scientists have already attempted to extract DNA from the ship's bilge. Many descendants were persuaded. "This community doesn't even have a grocery store," Fraser told local television, suggesting that $30 million could be put to better use. But Rains, the ship's discoverer, sees a missed opportunity to create a global landmark. "I hear a lot of people giving up," he said of the descendants, many of whom he has taken to the site. Their reluctance hasn't stopped him from launching a crusade to raise the wreck. He wants to enlist Oprah. "The Clotilda is an internationally important artifact," he told me. "It's not up to the descendants what happens to the ship. It belongs to the world." Darren Patterson, whose ancestors Polly Anderson spoke of as yearning for home until he died in 1922, wants to build a replica of the Clotilda, which he envisions facing east toward Africa. "Yorubans are very ingenious people," he said. "For my money, if they could have gotten their hands on a boat, they would have gotten back home." He was surprised when I told him that a similar project was under construction at the other end of Clotilda's voyage. But the Beninese government is building an enormous heritage tourism complex in Oda with a replica slave ship as its main attraction. Visitors will embark from a beach near the door of no return via small boats, then explore a hold crammed with more than 300 resin sculptures of captives. Groans and rattling chains may play over a speaker system. The French company designing the experience previously worked on the themed restaurant for children called Pirate's Paradise. Memorialization easily curdles into kitsch. There's also a certain awkwardness in Oda marketing such heritage to tourists whose ancestors it sold into slavery. Yet a Beninese tourism official assured me that diaspora historians had consulted on the replica, which wouldn't be too Disney. It might even educate his countrymen about slavery. "There was something missing after the door of no return," he insisted. For the Beninese, it wasn't clear why those from the diaspora were crying in front of the door. My first memory of the Atlantic slave trade is of a childhood visit to the freedom schooner Amistad in Sag Harbor, New York. I was dimly aware that I had enslaved ancestors, but seeing and hearing how they'd come to the country, even on a museum ship built to commemorate the famous Maritime Slave Rebellion, was a shock. It deepened when, as a teenager, I took up genealogy and realized that although I could trace my white mother's ancestry across centuries and continents, my black father's ended conclusively with a man named Moses who'd escaped from slavery in Virginia, swam across the Rappahannock River to join the Union Army, and left whatever he knew of his forebears behind. I'd arrived at what the poet Diane Brand describes as a rupture in history, a rupture in the quality of being that is distinctive to the African diaspora. We were not from the place where we lived, and we could not remember where we were from or who we were, she writes in A Map to the Door of No Return, recalling the childhood realization that her own grandfather was ignorant of their roots. The title evokes a watery void where all names were forgotten and all beginnings recast. The archaeology of slave ships has such appeal because it promises to fill this void, but it can do only so much to turn back time. Clotilda descendants are still waiting for DNA from the ship's timbers. Residents of the Quiloda Braco were taken aback to learn that many of the Camargo Africans were dispersed throughout southeastern Brazil. Contrary to their oral tradition, in which the majority were killed and a few survivors joined their community. The emphasis on precise continuity may be self-defeating. In Brazil, conservative media outlets have attempted to expose false Quilombos by casting doubt on their origin stories. In the United States, private reparation initiatives have been repeatedly undercut by debates over who exactly deserves to pay or be paid. During one of my Africa Town calls, which I made from the lobby of a hotel in New Orleans, a white man who overheard me began shouting that the wreck of the Clotilda was a scam and a hoax. The obsession with lineage is at odds with the solidarity of the Middle Passage, which created new forms of kinship. Africans who survived it had a word for those who traveled with them, whether or not they came from the same places or spoke the same languages. Shipmate. The poet Derek Walcott, in his masterpiece, Amorous, describe this emergence from anonymity as a kind of grace. But they crossed, they survived. There is the epical splendor. Multiply the rain's lances, multiply their rune. The grace born from subtraction as the hold's iron door rolled over their eyes like pots left out in the rain, and the bolt rammed home its echo the way that thunderclaps perpetuate their reverberation. Last May, during a celebration of the Camargo's discovery, a young priest from the Quilombo went to sea to bless the excavation. A practitioner of Candomblé, whose pantheon syncretizes Catholicism with various African cosmologies, he prayed to the spirits of his ancestors and those of others and prepared a tiny ceremonial urn called a Quatimba as a symbolic coffin for those who perished on board. He also scattered flowers for Imanja, Orishas of the Sea, as a way to conciliate her for the violation of the Camargo's voyage. The priest had learned to dive from the archaeologist, who watched from the dive boat's stern as he took a giant step overboard. A few moments later, he resurfaced, extending his hands to receive the cortina from the man on deck. Then he released the air from his vest and dropped to the bottom, cradling the urn as he vanished into the murk. He was descending not just into the bay, but also into the Kalunga, the watery underworld of Kikongo tradition, which fused in the Americas with memories of the crossing. A few months later, one of the archaeologists descended to the Camargo, searching for the buried cable that demarcates its location. Herself a devotee of the Orishas, she describes herself as a daughter of Ogum Marinho, whose point of strength is the bottom of the sea. That day she struggled to find the vessel and wasted precious minutes of air groping in the mud. Suddenly she felt something and froze. It was the Cortahina with a string of rosary beads beside it, both sitting on what she soon realized was the hole. She took a moment to pray. Then she plunged her hand into the silt and swam on, feeling for the line that crossed and circled the wreck. By Julian Lucas. Julian Lucas is a staff writer who began contributing to The New Yorker in 2018. A critic at large, the Gilded Age never ended. Plutocrats, anarchists, and what Henry James grasped about the romance of revolution by Adam Gopnik. More than a century before the arrival of Musk and Maggioni, a fascination with wealth was accompanied by a fascination with destruction and disruption by a belief in the benefits of burning it all down. When in the 1990s people decided that we were living in a new Gilded Age, the meaning was plain. The term, borrowed from the 1873 Mark Twain novel of the same name, a mediocre book by a great writer with a memorable title, like Anthony Trollope's The Way We Live Now, indicated an efflorescence of wealth and display of overabundance and nouveau riche excess. It referred mostly to the Veblen side of American life. Status, competition through showy objects, from the cloud-level duplexes of the New York skyline to the Met Gala. Perhaps not enough attention was paid to the original concept, which implied a contrast between the truly golden and the merely gilded. What we didn't anticipate was that our new Gilded Age would become even more like its precursor, not only in the seeming concentration of overwhelming wealth into fewer and fewer hands, but in the gravitation toward a plutocracy. In the Industrial Age, the totemic figures were Frick and Morgan and Rockefeller. In our post-industrial era, they are Bezos and Musk and Zuckerberg. During that first Gilded Age, if we imagine it running from the 1870s to 1910, a countercast of characters had a glamorous appeal of their own. These were the anarchists, whose isolated but highly publicized acts of individual retaliation were intended as inspirational, melodramatic theater rather than as actual revolutionary politics. In these years, anarchists claimed the lives of a French president, an American president, an Italian king, and a Russian czar, and threw bombs at several American tycoons. Whether or not Luigi Maggioni's recent alleged murder of a helpless insurance executive on a cold New York morning belongs to this tradition, its effect and effect certainly evoke the past, with the curly-haired, ivy-educated youth conferring in the realm of social media an improbable aura of martyrdom and purpose on what otherwise would have seemed a sordid act. How to make sense of their age and ours, one Gilded Age long gone and one now getting stripped of its shine? Henry James, famous for his timidity, his fastidiousness, his suspicion of anything meretricious or gaudy, might seem an unusual figure to lead this investigation, but he does just that in Peter Brook's new book, Henry James Comes Home, New York Review. Brooks tells the story of James's return to America in 1904 and his observations of the country after his happy childhood in pre-Civil War New York and his sojourns into Paris and London. The study is a companion piece to a volume that Brooks, an emeritus professor at Yale, wrote almost two decades ago, The Wonderful Henry James Goes to Paris. That book sought to understand why James, an abiding Francophile and a prescient admirer of French modernism, could not make a home for himself in Paris in the 1870s. Brooks offered, on James's behalf, some finely wrought speculations about the deceptively open nature of Parisian intellectual life, which remains true to this day. This book is not as good as that one, in part because it is more narrowly moralistic, with too much tut-tutting about New York as it was, and in part because where the Parisian story had to be extracted from letters and novels, this story is one that James himself laid out in a published account of his return, The American Scene. Inevitably, the job is given over more to paraphrase and gloss than to original narrative. We miss James's mature prose, the tension between endless fuss and decisive lucidity, the beautiful whistlerian fog that somehow lifts just long enough to show us things exactly as they are. Because the fog sometimes turns out to be the actual transmitter of illumination, the clarity rising from within the confusions, any simple summary or attempt to distill objective lessons betrays his mind. James was a racist of sort, while also an advocate for the writing of W.E.B. Du Bois. He could be an anti-immigrant and vestigially anti-Semitic. His visit to Ellis Island and to the Lower East Side is one of the more disagreeable things in all his writing. The denizens of the New York ghetto, heaped as thick as splinters on the table of a glass blower, had each, like the fine glass particle, his or her individual share of the whole hard glitter of Israel. But he was too intelligent not to recognize that the energy and purpose of the new New Yorkers would eventually overwhelm that of his class and kind. It is easy to become impatient with James, since the beautiful confusions sometimes recede to reveal simple hypocrisies. James and Brooks after him rasped indignant at the cottages built in Newport by members of the Nouveau regime. He was thinking of Vanderbilt and Whitney. But James rhapsodized about the stately homes of England, which differed mainly in having been built centuries instead of minutes before. And that's all we have time for today. By Adam Gopnik. Adam Gopnik is a staff writer who has been contributing to The New Yorker since 1986. His books include The Real Work, On the Mystery of Mastery. We are at the conclusion of this week's The New Yorker magazine program. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. Thank you for tuning in this week, and I invite you to join me next week for another new edition of The New Yorker magazine. Have a great week, and stay tuned for Sun Sounds of Arizona.